Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we've got a review of the new film, Annette, directed by Léos Carax and starring Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard. Plus, we continue our Wong Kar-wai marathon with a discussion of his 1995 film, Fallen Angels. Don't go anywhere. I talked all about the Bentonville Film Festival last time on the podcast. One of the great things about attending that festival virtually was being able to connect with so many filmmakers online. My guests today are two filmmakers whose film Boss Babes played that festival, and it was one of my favorite things I watched that week. Ryan Lagarde and Corey Clifford directed Boss Babes, and Corey also stars in it. It's a horror, thriller, comedy about multi-level marketing companies. But more on that in a second. Ryan and Corey stopped by the virtual pod booth recently, and in addition to telling us all about their film, they helped me break down the new film, Annette. Annette is from director Léos Carax. It stars Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard, and it's really something. It's a musical, it's very funny, it's very dark in places. It's just incredibly unique. I was so happy when Ryan and Corey said they'd discuss Annette with me because I really needed to talk to someone about it. All right, without further ado, here is my conversation with Ryan Lagarde and Corey Clifford. I'm here with Corey Clifford and Ryan Lagarde from the Boss Babes team. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us. It's so exciting.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We connected over Instagram recently with the Bentonville Film Festival. I got to see y'all's great short film, Boss Babes, as part of that festival. And I was so excited to meet you and kind of learn about your Arkansas connections, Corey, and then get you guys on the podcast. I'm always looking for podcast guests, so thank you.
Thank you so much. We were so supportive of Boss Babes. We were so excited to have that Instagram notification.
Well, good. I'm so glad we could connect, and it was a standout for me of that festival. I didn't have a ton of time to watch like a lot of features, but I made time for all the shorts, or almost all the shorts in that festival, and Boss Babes really stuck out to me. So tell us about Boss Babes. Where did this idea come from? How did you both get involved with it? How did it kind of start?
Well, Ryan and I have been creative partners for about 8 years now. So we've made a bunch of web series together, and we've done some other shorts in the past. And so we're kind of always looking for what our next project is going to be. And embarrassingly enough, several years ago, I was a part of a multi-level marketing pyramid scheme. Yes. I was at a low point when somebody saw that. And a friend of mine who was also an actor, I won't name which company it was, but she was like, I have this great opportunity for you. And I kind of got talked into it, and pretty much about, I don't know, a month into having to try and hawk products online and to my friends, I was like, what did I do? This is like, I don't know. It felt very kind of cultish to me. So luckily I was able to get out pretty quick. But when Ryan and I were talking about what we wanted to do next, we were kind of we wanted our next project to be something a little bit more cinematic. And I presented him this just very, very basic idea of kind of diving into this cultish world. And then Ryan and I just for a couple of months built the world of Boss Babes.
Wow. I love that. It's so relatable in a way, because so many of us, if we haven't been involved directly, we know people that are, and there's a certain connection, like immediately, like, oh, this is about MLMs. This is cool. I like this idea as watching the film. So, and it's so stylish too. So I always really didn't talk about like what it's about, but basically your character has a history of being in this, and find out you're stuck in it and can't get out of this contract. And then it goes to this kind of more thrillery kind of violent place, and that it's surprising, but it's also very funny. I was curious if there were any films or filmmakers or genres that you guys kind of drew inspiration from as you got this together style wise.
Sure, Ryan, you wanna take it?
Like one of the big things for us was like the dancing. And we just really like loved the idea of like having a dance, and that came like from, Ex Machina. So like Alex
Oh yeah, I
Garland's
love that
directorial
movie. Oh my
style is
gosh.
always like very, very interesting. And like not only because aesthetically it's very interesting, but he does a lot. There's a lot of just conversations in a lot of his movies. Like if you've seen like the Deus show that he did after Ex
Yes, love
Machina,
that show
that
too.
like, a lot of that just sits in these deep conversations and these weird like tension filled moments. So we definitely wanted to bring that to there to this short. And also the idea of like trapping her in this cultish world due to money and everything like that was us really taking that these MLMs do trap you, and they trap you in such a way like that they just attack the most vulnerable. And it looks like this glamorous life in all facets of it. But really, if you like dig deep into any kind of multi-level marketing, and Corey and I both like listen to podcasts on top of her own experience with it. And luckily she's like smart and got out of it and was able to like recover and all that and didn't, do everything. But not everyone's that, that lucky or has that kind of head on their shoulders to do that, and they get drowned. And some people don't recover if they give $500 somewhere. That's like everything they'd work for, and they just keep falling into the pit. And that's what these things breed off of, or breed off of, sorry.
Yeah, and then when we were kind of talking about visually, Ex Machina was like a huge inspiration, but then also Neon Demon, like the
I
pinks,
wondered
and
that
you can
one.
kind of,
Yeah, I love that film.
and the kind of group of scary women we really wanted to play
I
with.
totally thought about Neon Demon. I didn't think of the Alex Garland stuff, but that totally fits. And I love both of those things you mentioned, Ryan. And then I did think about like Kill Bill or something with some of the way the action plays out at the end. Felt like that. And
Totally.
yeah, some great touch points that I thought really, really worked.
If
I
you
didn't
can't get in
sorry.
a Quentin Tarantino movie, you just gotta, try and write a Quentin
There you
Tarantino
go.
esque fight scene for yourself.
It totally worked. I was wondering, and I didn't tell you guys I was going to ask you this, but are there, hopes to like expand this? Because it feels to me like this could be a series or a feature, because there's so much. Like, we get a little bit of your online videos at the beginning. Like, there's a lot of story that's kind of understood back there that it would be cool to see, I think. Has that ever
Thank
been something on
you.
your minds?
Yeah, that's actually, we're working on that right now.
Nice.
We just had another conversation about it yesterday. I think we're kind of seeing it more as like a mini series right now is what we're thinking, right,
We're thinking just like in kind of one of those, we've tossed around a bunch of different ideas, but our first like 8 episodes, just an 8 episode mini series that really focuses on Corey's character's journey. And then it could definitely be, we have all these different thoughts of like going into an anthology type thing where you're following different people,
Ooh, that's cool.
different MLMs that exist out there, because there's obviously the skincare. But then Corey and I did a deep dive into the world of like the handbags of MLMs,
Oh,
which is
yeah.
just insane. And then Amazon has a new like documentary coming out on the MLM, the not jeggings, but some kind of leggings one. And it's just like this world is messed up. So I
So
don't know if we can
crazy, yeah.
cuss, but it's just like
Yeah, totally. Feel free.
it's fucked up, man. It's so fucked. Like, I'm just like every time like Corey had me listen to this stuff, because I knew, and I was like, this seems dumb. And she's like, no, it's a lot darker than what I'm telling you. And it's great. I'm like, oh my God. I like genuinely feel like ours has some of that fantastical feeling to it. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't think this is that far a stretch.
Wow, it's not that far. That's so interesting. Yeah, it is. That is, I love the idea of the different MLMs and everything. So there's just like story beats that you could kind of build into that that really makes sense. I love it.
All
Well,
right.
what is kind of next for Boss Babes? So festival run still going, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we're still kind of in the festival run right now. We're playing at Dances with Films here in Los Angeles at the beginning of September, and then we up after that is Holly Shorts in Los Angeles as well, which is end of September, beginning of October. And then we're just still waiting to hear. It's like crazy doing the festival circuit. You realize it's kind of a full, it's like a whole nother year that you're like, okay, just submitting and waiting and Yeah, follow us on Instagram, Boss Babes Film,
Yes,
to
I'll do my best
see
to share
where it's
out. Yeah,
going.
that is
Thank
great.
you.
Yeah, I'll try to do my best to follow along and share to everybody what the latest is with this short, because yeah,
Thank
I
you.
really, really connected with it. So, all right, well,
Oh, we
thanks so
appreciate
much. Any
it.
final
Yeah.
thoughts on Boss Babes before we move on to Annette?
I just have to give a quick shout
Sure.
out to our cast who were just amazing. Like, we shot this the weekend before everything shut down
Oh,
in
wow.
the world with COVID. So we finished it right then. And then clearly, like, our executive producers who are also our cinematographers, Jack and Justin, and Jack, who also did all of the scoring and all of the editing. And those two brought more than we could ever thank them for to this project. They're both
For sure.
directors in their own right. They directed the entire first season and most second season of Stand Against Evil, and
Yeah. Wow.
they were the ones who helped fully create that fight scene and really make it happen. And Corey
Yeah.
went through an entire table for that fight scene, which was pretty dope. Pretty
Jack,
dope.
Jack is also an Arkansas
Oh,
native, or
great.
grew up there too. So you'll have to have him on sometime.
I absolutely. I'm gonna write this down. Here we go. Love it. Well, cool. Well, thanks so much. And
Thank you.
I'm really excited to see kind of where things go with Boss Babes and follow you guys going forward.
Awesome, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, all right. Let's move on and talk about Annette.
First time I fell in love, woke up next to the girl and escaped fast and far. But Anne has changed me. What I see in her is obvious. What she sees in me is, it's a little more puzzling.
One, two, three, four.
This is my baby.
Excuse me a minute.
Is nothing sacred to you?
Let's talk about Annette. This is the new film from director Léos Carax, and I know I'm going to butcher these French pronunciations. I'm so sorry for that. But it stars Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard, another pronunciation I'm not sure if I'm getting right. But it is a film that is based on music by Sparks, the band Sparks. And I'll just say it. It's a really weird movie. It's a really odd film. But it goes in all these different places. They're both artists and they are in love and they have a child and it kind of goes to all these confusing spaces or surprising spaces, but it's also a musical, so there's singing almost throughout the movie. And there's also just a lot of kind of odd touches to it, but it's I found it very funny. I found it surprising in a lot of ways, and I'm really curious. I haven't really talked to anyone else about this movie yet, and I'm curious to hear what people have to say. So, first of all, were either of you guys familiar with either the band Sparks or other films from Léos Carax before watching this?
I wasn't with Sparks. I was with Holy Motors, but
Okay.
that was the only other movie that I had known of his before this.
What about you, Ryan?
I wasn't with either. No, I was a
Okay.
goose egg on both of those.
There you go. Well, and I have not seen anything else from Léos Carax. I know a little bit about Holy Motors. I know his films are generally kind of unusual, maybe kind of like this. And I know a little bit about Sparks just because Edgar Wright, who's one of my favorite directors, did a documentary about them that came out earlier this year. It was kind of, I think it was delayed, I think, because of pandemic. But anyway, did finally come out. And I, you know, knew nothing about them. I think I'd heard one of their songs before, but learned so much about them from this documentary. They've been working for decades, and they're these really interesting alternative rock musicians who the whole point of the documentary was kind of like, these guys have been under the radar. Nobody knows about them, but they've been around forever, and you've probably heard their music. And so just a really interesting creative pair. And then I knew that it actually mentions it in the documentary that they've worked on this film. You see Adam Driver for just a second, like in the documentary. But then when this was like announced, like, oh, that's the movie, that's the Sparks movie. So anyway, it was interesting. I've listened to them quite a bit since then, but I know I'm a new fan, I guess, of Sparks. But their music is odd and probably a good pairing for Leos Carax. But yeah, so sure. I think the reviews have been kind of mixed. It's been probably kind of divisive, maybe because it is kind of so strange. But what is y'all's overall kind of impressions, overall negative or positive? What do you think?
Well, I've been dying to talk about this movie with somebody too. Since I've watched it, I've been like texting everybody I know, like, have you watched? It's interesting that it's like so polarizing. I'm on the side of, I loved it. Like, yes. I have not been able to stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
I was in for the ride. The opening song like totally had me hooked, which I actually do think is the best song of the movie, but I was hooked. I loved it.
Yeah. What about you, Ryan?
So I, in a similar fashion, cannot stop thinking about it. And also, I think the opening song like was the best song in the movie as well. And it has me hooked. I've been kind of singing it in my head for multiple days in a row now. But I like didn't like it from a film standpoint, but I loved it from an acting standpoint. Like Corey and I met, like we both met in the acting class together, and I see like why any actor would want to be a part of it.
Mm. Yeah, we'll talk about the performances, but like what a acting challenge.
Oh my God, yeah.
Being musical, being a stand-up comedian for Adam Driver. We'll talk about that in a minute. I think I'm more on Corey's side. I really liked it a lot. And I mean, it was, I didn't realize quite how musical it was going to be. Like I knew there's some songs. I kind of thought it's going to be a straightforward story with some songs thrown in, but it's like, they're singing dialogue.
It's opera.
Yeah, that's right. About a third of the way through, I was like, oh, this is an opera. And that kind of clicked for me. It's like, okay. And that kind of helped me enjoy it more, I think, too.
Me too.
I really didn't know quite how much, like I knew Sparks was involved too. I didn't know like I think they wrote a lot of the story too. And again, just recently becoming a fan of them, but it really feels like you've been sucked into a Sparks album. And I think that's part of the intention of that opening song is like they're in the studio
totally.
And then they bust out and now we're like, we're in their world in a way, which is a really cool way to do that, I thought.
I had read a bunch of, I can't stop thinking about this movie. So I've like been reading all of these things that I can find out and everything.
Yeah. I had just read that Sparks originally, this was like, they were going to tour it like as a big musical before then approaching Leos Carax, as I always say his name.
Yeah, that sounds right.
about turning it into a movie. But I thought that was really interesting because it does totally feel like something obviously that you could just see on stage too.
Yeah, like you could almost just listen to this album and think it's just another Sparks album, maybe like a concept record or something, because it's weird in the same ways as a lot of their music. It's kind of long-winded in a way. I thought that's my one kind of critique, is that I think the movie is maybe just a little long, but
I agree.
But yeah, let's talk about those performances. Adam Driver, he really is the lead. I think that it's, they're kind of co-leads, but it ends up being his movie. I'm a big fan of him anyway. And so I was really curious to see him in this. And it's pretty different than most of his other things. I haven't seen him sing this much. He has that one song in Marriage Story at the end. That's so great.
Right.
But here he is throughout. And then, I mean, yeah, what a challenge as far as the stand-up. I noticed in the credits, there's like a little... it's like Adam Driver, special thanks to Chris Rock and Bill Burr. And so I wonder if he must have like reached out to them for like, how do I do this kind of stand-up stuff.
Right.
Yeah, what do y'all think about his performance?
Oh my gosh, I thought he was phenomenal. I feel like this is like the most, I was telling Ryan this, like the most Adam Driver role.
Nice.
Like he's getting to play the brooding, the the love interest, all of the things. But yeah, the stand-up stuff was some of the stuff that stood out to me the most. I was like, I feel like I've never seen anything really done like that before. And I just found him, you know, obviously he's a very large man already.
Yeah, that's true.
So to see him like kind of towering over everybody and just, I don't know, I was mm-hmm. pretty blown away by his performance.
Same. It just, everything that he brings, I think that the coolest thing about Adam Driver to me, I'm like a big, big sports fan, and Adam Driver is clearly like an athlete. Mm-hmm. You know, he has an athletic body, he's a very good athlete that can act, which isn't something you see that often. And when yeah. they combine like moves of boxing and then like the physicality that he can bring to a role mm-hmm. on top of just his amazing like acting abilities, it's something that makes him so unique that I'm fixated on him at all times. Like really mm-hmm. just in any point he's in it, even literally when the smoke is coming up and it's behind him and he looks like a boxer coming out into the yeah. audience, I'm like, he's like the greatest person ever. And you see his fucking face. This dude is it. I'm like so jealous of this shot.
Yeah.
You know, like that kind of feel.
That's so cool. I love it. Yeah. And so like being able to like maintain the seriousness amidst the absurdity too is so interesting. Like when they start mm-hmm. singing, like that was one of, among the biggest surprises of this, which is like how much the singing is a part of everything. It's like the paparazzi
right.
are singing at them. They're singing while they're making love. They're singing.
Yeah.
And then like the audience is singing back and forth to him. I love this scene where he's mad at them. Like they have the angry song and
so
he's
good.
Like cussing them out and they're like, get off the stage. That was so interesting.
Was so interesting too, that they were singing live. Did you know that? I read that afterwards that they were singing live the whole time.
Really? I did I completely assumed the opposite. That's amazing.
Yes, I did too. Yeah. So I was listening to an interview with Marion Cotillard, and she said that she like while rehearsing for the movie and stuff, she had to like train singing lying down or singing running or bending over because,
wow.
you know, normally you would just be in a booth for it, but
yeah.
they weren't. So
that's amazing. I did not know that at all.
Wow. I didn't know that either.
Let's talk about her. So I think she's really great too. She has less screen time. It's interesting. Like I feel like Adam Driver does a great job in those comedy scenes, and then I don't know much about opera at all, but it seems like she does a great, you know, job as an operatic singer. But I really like, there's one scene that she gets where, you know, she's on the stage and then she's kind of in this forest. It goes out the back of the stage and is in the woods. I thought that was a really beautiful, just visually, like so much of this film visually is great.
Beautiful.
But then, so like, they're kind of playing it straight amidst the absurdity, but also like playing against this puppet. Like that was such an interesting thing.
Oh my gosh.
Once Annette is born and you kind of realize slowly, okay, that's not supposed to look like a real child. And then, but they keep like, it feels like real emotions, everyone around her, kind of keeping that going. So anyway, I thought that was a really cool thing about it. What else
totally.
Did you like
I
about
was...
Marion's performance?
I mean, she's obviously extremely beautiful, but and she playing opposite Adam Driver feels so delicate, and not just the way that she looks, but the way that she sings and all of her acting. She just has like this delicateness to her, which I just found so interesting and also very magnetic to watch.
Yeah, I think that something that she always brings is that like she's played like the good person, but then also like kind of evil in different ones, like in her last two like Christopher Nolan movies, she was just like had this like strength to her, and it's like it just shows like not only her range, but that she's still so powerful while she's so vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Right,
it's like really impressive to watch things like that, to watch this powerful person be overpowered by like Adam Driver's character, but not in an acting sense and not in a performance sense. Just like she can just show like that coweringness, but then the next moment show how big she actually is. It's just very, very powerful to watch.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely a highlight. And then I love when we get scenes of her, kind of, I guess, a mild spoiler halfway through the movie, of like a ghost version of her. That's
yes.
like a fun kind of twist on that too.
I
also really like Simon Helberg. So I haven't seen him in much else,
him.
But I thought he was so good in this. Like, he every time he was on screen, I was kind of glued to him. And then shortly after, I was like, okay, this is an opera. Like kind of like understanding it on that level. He has a song. So he has the song where he's like, I'm an accompanist, but then later he's like directing or he's conducting.
Right.
And he's like filling us in on some of the story. And then he says, hold on just a second or something like that. And like has to conduct the music. I love that moment. I thought that was so cool.
It was so good. I thought that he was so impressive too. And it was so fun to see him no, I don't want to spoil anything, but like when he's going head to head with Adam Driver, because just, you know, visually they're so different looking, but I feel like he really held his own against such a big presence as Adam Driver. And I found him pretty incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
What else, any kind of other favorite things about this movie or least favorite? What are your issues with it, Ryan?
So it's one of those things where I was like, I love movies in general. Like I very rarely I'm like, oh, I don't like the movie. So like, I like the movie. It's just there's aspects of, I think I would have liked it as a performance by the Sparks more. Like I would have liked seeing live. Like sometimes in the fantastical world, I like, it loses me a bit. Whereas if I saw them on stage, I probably would have walked out and been like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. But when I walk in a movie and like what you're saying, like she goes from the forest into, like from the stage into the actual forest. And that's like the beauty of movies, right? We can perform that. But when you're watching something on stage, it's like you can viscerally feel that in a different way where maybe you're not seeing it. And then sometimes when I see it, I'm like, ugh, but no, I just want to see her in the black box. Let's just do that more. And that kind of thing. So that's where I kind of get lost in what I was telling Corey. But then, you know, I know it's like, I still like it if I'm walking down the street and I'm just thinking about it all the time. So, and then the parent to child dynamic was really powerful for me. I had a son during the pandemic, and so I have a little 15-month-old over here. So watching anything with kids now, I'll just like cry. that last scene, I'm like, no, this is fine. I'm fine. I'm totally fine. Like, not seeing your kid anymore. Oh my God, this is heartbreaking.
That last scene was incredible. Yeah, like I just. Wow, that was amazing.
And the performer, the way that
just the way that they dealt with the puppet. Like at first when you see the puppet, you're like, wait, what? But I mean, I was totally sucked into the world of it though. I was like feeling for the puppet. I loved the puppet. Like I thought they did such a good job of bringing her to life.
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought it was like so much like a ghost story where like in the ghost you could feel all the emotions and you could feel everything of that puppet, and it, and that's what gets you, right? Like if you can feel the emotion, you can buy into any
Absolutely. And so I've been trying to like piece together like why choose a puppet in this role, and maybe y'all can shed some light. But I think it probably has something to do with, you know, there's a lot of about like art and exploitation in this movie, and they kind of argue about like, are we exploiting her voice and all of that? And in a way she becomes a puppet to her father in a sense. So that's kind of the only thing I'm able, that's the answer I've been able to figure out so far. But
I've been thinking about that a lot too, and I think that's a really great insight to it. I think that totally could be. And then I also think it is kind of an interesting look at fame, obviously the whole movie, and Marion Cotillard's character being like this very like critically acclaimed, doing something like considered quote unquote high art where he's, you know, a stand-up comedian. But kind of how you all like when being a performer or an actor, you're kind of always selling a bit of your soul or a bit of yourself. And I don't know, that like being a puppet for other people sort of. So I don't know. I was trying to pull from that some.
I love that. And that makes sense. And like that seems to be wrapped up in like his performances. And both of them talk about like how the audience reacts, and like you die every night on stage as this opera singer to save them, and I go and try to make them laugh. And I think that's really, and to your point too about the celebrity aspect of it, like we get all these paparazzi or like news clips about like what's going on with their lives, which kind of points to that too. I think that's cool,
right?
But it sort of ends up being this kind of deconstruction of art and also kind of a family. But I love the like the meta reflections on art and kind of like why we're doing what we're doing as artists and all of that. That was really
absolutely
absolutely.
I also think it's just very funny. As kind of my last thing to say is like I continually was laughing. Like even little things, like there's a moment late in the film where Adam Driver, it just like cuts to him and he's laying in the baby bed in the crib and like holding her neck, and his huge long legs are sticking through the side. Like just a funny visual there that made me laugh. But
I know, and I love how seriously like Adam Driver and Simon Helberg, I think his name, like they're taking with Annette, the puppet, how seriously they're taking it all. And like, there's no like winking, I feel like. So then it allows you to see the absurdity in it too. And it like kind of makes it more funny that way too.
Yeah. And I think it kind of, it makes it obvious that like there's something else going on. Like it kind of adds that layer of satire to it all. But even like absurd things about like his name is Henry McHenry and like things like that. I'm like, oh, just laughing throughout it. Well, do y'all have any final thoughts on Annette? Thanks so much for chatting about it.
Absolutely. I think everybody should see it. It's so, it's just such a think piece too. I feel like it's a movie I want to talk about with more people.
Yes. Yeah, so same as you guys both said, like, I like this was watching it. And then I, like, as I, as, continue to think about it, can't get out of my head, like I like it more and more as time goes on. So yes, that is Annette. That is streaming on Amazon Prime. It played in theaters for like a week here in Little Rock. I wish I had seen it on the big screen. I think it would be really a cool experience. But it is on Amazon, so easy to get to. And that is Annette. Thank you guys so much for joining the podcast today. I best of luck with Boss Babes, and I would absolutely love to have you back again sometime in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much. This has been an awesome, fun time to talk about movies.
Thank you so much. Thanks again, Ryan and Corey. I had a great time talking with them, and I loved hearing their thoughts on Annette. I'm very excited to see where their film Boss Babes takes them. Next up on the show, we continue our Wong Kar-wai marathon. I've really enjoyed working through these films with Omaya Jones. So far, we've looked at As Tears Go By, Days of Being Wild, and Chungking Express. And today, we're digging into the fourth film in the Criterion box set, Fallen Angels. Omaya Jones is a film podcaster from Central Arkansas. He's responsible for the screenings in the Arkansas Times film series, and he's just a really good guy. Welcome back to the podcast again, Omaya Jones. How's it going today?
It's going pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, yeah. Trucking along, I guess. Just staying busy and enjoying this Wong Kar-wai set, continuing to enjoy. And so I'm excited to talk about Fallen Angels with you in just a minute. But before we do, I thought we might talk about what else we've been watching lately. Have you seen anything else recently?
I have been watching more movies lately since I've completed my watch of NYPD Blue. And so this past week, I rewatched Nicholas Ray's The Lusty Men, which is a sort of like rodeo Western. I finally caught up with Promising Young Women.
What do you think of that?
I liked it a lot. I thought that it was really adept at not... I'm sort of like, how do I want to say it? You know, sometimes when we have these conversations that are sort of around Me Too and things, I know like some guys will say things like not all men, but what I think the movie does a good job is to say like actually everyone is complicit in sort of the system and the injustice around these things. And I thought, like, I liked it a lot, especially like the ending, because it didn't feel like it, without spoiling it, you know, it's not a cop out. And it felt honest and true. I think it centers it around like the character of Cassie and sort of everything that she's going through. And I thought that it felt sort of true to that. I also, like, this weekend, I ended up watching Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby and Romeo and Juliet back to back. I didn't intend to. It just kind of happened that way.
I've seen both of those, but it's been a long time.
Yeah, part of the impetus, like, I started with The Great Gatsby, and part of the impetus behind that is, like, a couple years ago, it entered the public domain, and so I feel like since then, it has just sort of come up in my life more and more. So, like, first, when it entered the public domain on NPR's Planet Money, they did a reading of it on their podcast, so they had the different reporters from Planet Money reading chapters, and then this year, in lieu of running reruns on Nick DeMeo's The Memory Palace, he released a three-part of him reading it. So I was like, oh, you know what? I never actually saw Baz Luhrmann's film, so I'll check that out. And then the last thing that I saw that I've seen recently that I would highly recommend people seek out is this movie called Red Belt by David Mamet. And it was on, I think it was on like Stars or something. But I hadn't seen it since it was released in theaters, which I think was like in 2008. And David Mamet is this interesting filmmaker, and that he comes to film from the world of theater, and he's a dramatist. He's also a conservative in Hollywood, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. His politics to me seem really incoherent, but that's beside the point. Like, Red Belt itself is this film that's sort of about the corrupting influence of money and sort of having to navigate that and battle the impulse to sort of take the easy way out and accept these corrupting influences within yourself and sort of staying true to yourself. And so, yeah, I would recommend people see Red Belt and sort of just think about how they can apply the lessons to their own life, if it fits. But yeah. What about you?
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't heard of Red Belt, so I'll check that out. That's really interesting. Yeah, I watched a bunch of new stuff in the theater, actually. The theater down the road from my house is like empty most of the time, so I feel pretty safe going there, which, you know, is sad for movies, but good for me. I watched Free Guy, which is that new Ryan Reynolds one, and I kind of didn't have high expectations for it, but I really liked it, actually. It's as far as I know, Ryan Reynolds kind of plays the same character in everything, roughly, but this is less of a Deadpool kind of Ryan Reynolds and more like Just Friends, that kind of level of silliness, which is a movie that my wife really loves, so we've watched it many times over the years, so I kind of appreciate that about it, and I thought it was pretty clever. Also, the co-lead, Jodie Comer, is really great. She is in the show Killing Eve, which we've been watching through. And she's fantastic in that. She's like the main villainelle in that show. And she's the co-lead in Free Guy. So anyway, if you're into, you know, big, silly action movies, Free Guy is a lot of fun. I also watched The Night House, which is a new horror movie starring Rebecca Hall that I didn't really know much about. I just thought it was getting decent reviews. And it was one of the new things, directed by David Bruckner. I thought this was really, really good. It's pretty low key, kind of slow burn horror kind of thing. It's more or less a ghost story about this house that she lives in by herself that her late husband built, and she's kind of going through grief. And it is really interesting. It ends up being kind of a mystery thriller, in addition to being, I thought, genuinely pretty creepy and scary. So I will recommend The Night House. And then I also watched Reminiscence, the new Lisa Joy film, which I was really curious to see, and I liked it, didn't love it, but I think it has a lot of good things going for it. It feels a lot like, so Lisa Joy, of course, is married to Christopher Nolan, and I'm a pretty big fan of his, but, and she also, Lisa Joy made Westworld, so it definitely, you could feel some connective tissue with that, and just similar to a lot of Christopher Nolan stuff in the way it's kind of looking at time, and it's this mind-bending sci-fi kind of thing. But I actually liked it a whole lot more than I liked Tenet, which was, you know, Christopher Nolan's latest thing. But Reminiscence reminded me more than anything of Inception. It has a lot to do with memory and that kind of stuff. But it's set in this kind of, it's not dystopian exactly, but it's the future. It's in Miami. And one of the interesting things about it is like the city is flooded. And it never exactly explains why, but I think the implication is global warming has caused that. And it's also, so it's like there's all these parts of the city are flooded entirely. The parts that are inhabited, they're like walking around in waist, or not waist deep, but like ankle deep water all the time. So it's a really interesting kind of visual. And then also the night, the city has become nocturnal because it's too hot during the day to go out. So it's like a noir in a way. And Hugh Jackman ends up, he's the lead, and he ends up kind of trying to solve a mystery. It really is like a sci-fi noir kind of thing. And he's kind of the hard world detective character, but he runs this memory nostalgia business. It's kind of confusing, but the trailer explains it pretty well. Rebecca Ferguson is sort of the femme fatale character. And I thought it was all in all pretty good. Like, there's probably only like one good action scene. A lot of the action is kind of boring. A lot of the dialogue is pretty bad, but the setting I thought was really good. And like the ending, it wasn't great, but I thought it was pretty strong. So yeah, and that one's on HBO as well. It's one of the HBO Max day and date releases. So if that sounds interesting, if you're really into Hugh Jackman, I think you'll have a lot to like about the movie, because he's a whole lot he's in it a whole lot. Almost every scene, he's the lead. So anyway, that's Reminiscence. And then the last thing is Annette, which I won't go into a lot of detail about because that is actually the first half of this episode. I talked with a couple of new friends about Annette, but I am curious. Have you watched Annette, Omaya?
No, I haven't. I might try to watch it this weekend. I wanted to watch it last weekend. I ended up when I had time. I don't know. I like went out one night and then I came back and I just decided to fall asleep on the couch with a movie on. And I ended up falling asleep to Reminisce instead of Annette.
Oh, really?
Yeah. and then did not feel the need to like go back and actually watch it. I will. I don't know. But yeah, I am excited to see Annette. I've only seen Holy Motors. I think it's the only Lia Karoff film that I've seen.
I have not seen any. And I know a little bit about Holy Motors. But anyway, yeah, Annette is super weird. I really liked it, though. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts. And of course, you can listen in. I met a couple of filmmakers at the Bentonville Film Festival and talked to them earlier today, actually, and recorded that about Annette. So that was fun. But that's boring to listeners because you've just heard that interview. You're listening to this episode through. So yeah, that's all my stuff. But yeah, I having watched some new stuff, I wanted to run through it pretty quick. But all right, well, I guess let's talk about Fallen Angels. All right, let's talk about Fallen Angels. So this film came out in 1995. This is the next film in the Wong Kar-wai, World of Wong Kar-wai Criterion box set. And it came right after Chungking Express in the set and in his filmography. Although, Omaya, is this true that Ashes of Time came out in between these two?
Right. So even though Ashes of Time was shot and mostly edited before Chungking Express, because the editing went long and they shot Chungking Express in like 6 weeks and they finished it pretty quickly, it came out before Ashes of Time. And then so then Fallen Angels came out a couple years later after actually, I guess like the next year after Chungking Express. Yeah.
Okay. What's interesting, it very closely tied to Chungking Express, both in kind of the, at least the way it's shot and a little bit of the same structure, similar structure. And so I'm sure we'll go ahead and say this, that Wong Kar-wai conceived when he was writing Chungking Express, had three stories actually, only two of them made it into that film, Chungking Express, and the third one ended up becoming Fallen Angels. And Fallen Angels also has basically two stories, but they don't run back to back like Chungking Express. They really do kind of intertwine. They don't connect exactly, but we go back and forth, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So Chungking Express is about two police officers and kind of their struggles and love life. This one is about two criminals. And so the first character is a killer for hire, and he has an interesting relationship with his business partner. Who she's obsessed with him, it would seem, and that plays out in interesting ways. And then the other character is Takeshi Kaneshiro, and he who plays Cop 223 in Chungking Express here plays the second criminal, and his crime is kind of odd. He breaks into shops a lot and just messes around in there. Yeah. acts like he's working.
He pretends to run. Yeah.
Yeah. He like runs the shop like in the middle of the night when there's no one there. At a lot of different places. And that's not exactly clear at first. You kind of see him in different places. You're like, what is this guy's job? And he'd have all these jobs. And he's breaking into these. And this is like a weird thing that he's doing. And he also has some sort of romantic longings and interacts with some characters kind of in connection with that. So that's kind of the broad strokes of what this story is about. It is kind of, in a lot of ways, it feels like a counterpoint to Chungking Express. I think at some point in one of the interviews, I think with Christopher Doyle, he said something about Chungking Express being a daytime movie and this being a nighttime movie. Although Chungking Express also kind of has a day and night,
right,
half and half. But this one, it is more of a nighttime feeling. It takes place entirely at night. And it's more gritty, I think, and more kind of grimy, maybe.
Yeah, it's also it's way more violent, too. You know, well, yeah. I guess there is some violence in Chungking Express, but this film has several scenes of intense violence, almost a throwback to As Tears Go By. There's some overlap in terms of things like the locations, themes, both with like the air travel, some repeating music. Chungking Mansions is again a location here, but much of it takes place in a different part of Hong Kong. There are different lines of dialogue, references to expiration dates and things like that also carry over.
There's a few lines of dialogue that I think are exactly repeated, which is interesting, but of course from completely different characters and everything. Brief reaction to the film, a couple things that you like about it.
I guess it's tough because I remember the first time that I saw it with a couple friends. They came over, we were trying to decide what to watch, and I think at the time it was streaming on Netflix. And this was like, I actually checked because like Letterboxd, you know, it tells you when you log things, so this was like 2010. And I remember at the time thinking that I don't know. Maybe it was a situation where I was just like watching it when I was tired or something. Cause I don't remember it being very coherent. And this time I thought it was much more coherent than I remembered. And I think it also benefits from having watched it back to back with Chungking Express. But there's just something about it that does not gel for me. And I think I think it would work better if it were tacked on to Chungking Express and edited somehow, or maybe if it was like further detached and just more differentiated,
its own thing.
Like one way or the other, but like where it is, it kind of sits in the middle, and there are things that aspects that I like from the cinematography mostly, but a lot of it just for whatever reason doesn't work as much for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. It definitely took me longer to kind of like grasp onto the story. Like I had to really be like, okay, what exactly is going on for the first 20-30 minutes, which is similar to Chungking Express, I guess, because I feel like most of the really kinetic camera movement happens at the beginning of that film and of this one, that the camera almost never stops moving for the first like almost hour of this film. We're following the killer around and then his partner who's cleaning up for him and all of that, and it's just like going, and it doesn't stop to like explain anything, of course, but it took me a while, and it feels like it's maybe looser, like Chungking Express as kind of like it feels kind of loosey-goosey as you're watching it, but it's like thematically very tight, and like there's not a whole lot of excess, whereas this one it feels like the different threads of the story are kind of further apart from each other, so I think I had a little more trouble kind of engaging with it for that reason also, but I did end up really liking it. Probably like the least, I don't want to say that I like it the least out of the set, that's not what I'm trying to say, but the least I've kind of really felt connection to the films of the set, but I still really did like it a lot. There's a lot to enjoy about it. Well, let's talk about, so we've kind of been talking about this already, but kind of in context of Wong Kar-wai's filmography, kind of we already talked about where it came in the lineup and how it was kind of conceived. It as far as like the actors that carry over, I was looking to see, is there anyone besides Takeshi Kaneshiro that is repeated from at least from a previous film? There is the character of
the dad
character, yes. So a lot of the second half, which is following Takeshi Kaneshiro's character, whose name is He Jiwoo, he's mute, voluntary mute, it seems like. He doesn't talk, which in one of the deleted scenes, Wong Kar-wai has a little commentary about that, and just says he saw a lot of comedic ability in Takeshi Kaneshiro and wanted to kind of give him this challenge. And he is really funny without any words, which is interesting. But his character's father is like a hotel manager slash cook. And a lot of it is about their relationship and kind of how they relate and how that affects Hajiwoo as certain things happen with his father. I'll try not to spoil anything, but I thought that was really good. And so that actor, whose name is Manley Chan, he actually was the front desk or an employee of Chungking. What is it? Chungking Hotel. It's part of Chungking Mansion. Chungking Mansion,
yes.
And he's in Chungking Express for just a shot, kind of the woman in the blonde wig interacts with him. But then here in this one, he's a full character, like a big part of the film. So yeah, I think as far as that goes, those are the two carryovers among the actors. The person who plays the killer, Leon Lai, has he in any other Wong Kar-wai films? I'm looking to see. It doesn't look like he is. I thought he was good in this. He plays kind of a badass killer is kind of his whole vibe, and he doesn't. But then you end up seeing him kind of soften, and I think it's interesting too. Like he puts on the killer kind of persona in a way, but he, you know, we see him as just a person. And one of the funniest things in the whole movie to me is we see him multiple times. We see him like go into a place and just kill everybody, just shoot up the place and kill everyone. And he comes out at one point and gets on the phone and says, I just want to double check the address, make sure I did the right place. Like he just killed all the wrong people potentially. That really made me laugh. But yeah, so that's his character. And then so his partner, who I didn't realize at first, but she's actually kind of dropping the next job for him at his apartment, as well as cleaning up his apartment. But they never interact, like they almost never see each other. But she's in love with him, and she goes to his trash, and she goes to the bar that he always goes to when he's not there. She sits in his seat, and there's an interesting line of dialogue about she wants to... She's kind of obsessed with him, but she doesn't want to get to know him too well, because something about that would, like, you can lose interest if you get to know a person too well. That was interesting. As we look at like Wong Kar-wai and all the themes of connection and all of the things in all of his films, this idea that you sometimes get too close to a person, and that potentially sort of happens in one of the relationships in this movie. Actually, there's a breakup that is a big part of the kind of the final third of this. So that's Michelle Reyes plays the partner.
Can I say,
yeah, go ahead.
I was like, their relationship is like the exact inverse of the relationship of cop was like 6'3" and
Tony Leung.
Right. Yeah. Of Tony Leung. Yeah. And like in both instances, the woman is going to the other person's apartment and doing their various things, but obviously, the motives are actually pretty similar too, right? Like when I get to know this person, but not get too close. Mm-hmm. I just point to the idea of like this being like the dark cousin or something of Chucky Express.
Yeah. I didn't make that connection, but that's exactly right. That's really interesting. There's a great jukebox scene. I guess we're kind of just getting into movie details at this point too, which is fine. There's a jukebox scene where she's dancing, like kind of extended. I put in my notes, she's vibing hard. She like puts the quarter in and she's just like head against the machine. There's all these close-ups of the actual jukebox, which is interesting. And she's smoking and the smoke looks cool and all that. But then the jukebox is used thematically in a really cool way where he leaves a hint for her and basically uses that as a breakup tool. And it's kind of like, I'm quitting my job and I'm kind of breaking off our relationship too. And he leaves a coin and with the bartender says, tell her this, and I play a particular song. And then the song is the breakup. I thought it was a pretty cool touch. Their relationship is interesting and kind of comes back in the end as well. And then he meets Blondie, who is in a McDonald's, and that's Karen Mok. She kind of feels like the Fei Wong of this movie in a way, that just because she's so high energy and kind of her physical presence is like just all over the place in a way. She kind of seduces him, is maybe not the right word, but draws him in, and they have a relationship. And he kind of, similarly to in Chungking Express, we have Tony Leung, you know, has just gone through a breakup and then meets someone. The killer character has just gone through his breakup and then meets her at this McDonald's, and they strike up a relationship for a lot of the movie. And yet we see her apartment, and yeah, there's some really interesting scenes between those two characters. And then as we get kind of later into the film, we have Takeshi's character. We get the father stuff we already talked about, but then he also interacts with Charlie Young, is the actress who plays Charlie in the film. And she is kind of maybe mentally unstable. It seems like she is screaming on the phone to everyone. I think it's interesting too that, you know, she's very, very, very talkative, like never stops talking, and he's mute, right? So he like never talks, and there's kind of an interesting dynamic between them. And they end up connecting, and then going all over the city before she kind of disappears. And there's actually another parallel line between Chungking Express and this, is that Tony Leung has all the narration about kind of airplanes and relationships, and I had to clear the runway for the next relationship, and like I kind of makes all those kind of almost puns about that. And he says something about I have it in my notes, hold on.
While you're looking for that, like in terms of like the airplanes, not only do we see one of the characters in the flight in a flight attendant uniform at the end, there's also a shot that is very explicit of airplanes flying overhead, like earlier in the film. And I remember when I saw it, I took note of that, like, that's just like the last film. And I knew, you know, knowing that the two are connected thematically and conceptually. And then, then it becomes very easy just to like look and see like there are more references to airline travel and things.
Yeah. And that, so I found that line. It's, I'm just a stopover in the journey of her life, which is actually not Takeshi's character. That's the killer talking, narrating about his breakup near the end of the film. But there's that connection. I was thinking of, Takeshi talks about expirations, getting back to his character in Chungking Express. He says, I thought that, Charlie is kind of obsessed with her ex, as even as they're spending this time together and having this connection. And he says something about, I thought they would expire, but it turns out my expiration date came up first, or something like that. So that very much connects back as well. So I think it's kind of all the major characters and kind of a winding way through a lot of the plot of the movie. Let's talk about what is in the set, the Wong Kar-wai set here. So we have the film, and we'll talk about versions in a second here, but on the disc also is a really cool little feature. It's about 15 minutes. It's called Wong Kar-wai Artist to Artist, and it's 10 questions, and it was filmed in 2020, and it's all these other filmmakers and writers sending video questions to him, and he answers them all in kind of a in one go, but it's kind of cut in between. So we have like Sofia Coppola, Lisa Joy, Chloe Zhao is on there, Ryan Johnson's on there. It's really a cool little feature. Did you watch that one, Amaya?
I did watch that. I just going to the idea of like not knowing how time works, I saw like Bradford Young on there. And you know, he's a cinematographer. I think he shot Solo, and he's known for like really pushing the boundaries in terms of like minimal uses of light in photography. This is not really about the film, but I just assumed that we were roughly the same age, and he just ages really well. He's like 44. I don't know. like he says something like, I've been watching his film since he was like 17 or 18. Really, yeah. And I thought, in my head, I was like, oh, he's probably like 27. And then it's like, oh no, he's 44. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. I wish that feature had been longer, actually. Like, I don't know how, I don't like, in my head, I'm thinking about like, obviously it's the way it's shot and the way it's put together, as a result of COVID, right? Because they're all these video questions, that are sent in. And I wish there were more of a conversational aspect to it, but I don't know how that would be if you had like 10 filmmakers.
Yeah.
All just sort of like pelting Wonka Rai with
huge
questions.
Zoom call.
Yeah. But it's also funny because like there's this element of Wonka Rai just being cool because he's sitting there with his sunglasses. Yeah. And he's sort of like answering philosophically, and as these people sort of like pelt him with praise for his filmmaking career.
Yeah, it's cool to see these people kind of appreciating. I always like hearing filmmakers appreciate other filmmakers. And so there's a lot of that here. They ask about kind of the themes of time in his work. One of the writers who I'm going to not pronounce this correctly, probably, but Andre Aciman, who I'm not familiar with, but he had a great question about sort of the, this is going to help me like think about films going forward in this set, but kind of restraint versus excess. And so like there's certain storylines that there's a ton of restraint, which like I know In the Mood for Love is kind of known for that. There's like a lot that are kind of dialed down, but then there's others that are kind of really kinetic or violent, or these characters are, you can almost like Chungking Express, we have the first half is like, so it's the more action heavy, and it's and there's a lot just physical movement, and then in the second half it's a lot more reserved, and these characters seem to have feelings for each other but don't say anything. And yes, I thought that was a cool way to think about him as a filmmaker, as having these two kind of extremes of restraint and excess. Chloe Zhao asked him about loneliness. I thought that was perfect because she always has really a lot of loneliness in her films, at least the ones I've seen. And he ended up talking about characters in his films kind of finding themselves in isolation, and isolation being an important part of his films, which totally made me think about Officer 223 in the first half of Chungking Express, and you know, running on his own and kind of having that moment of growth in that scene. And yeah, so that's something I'm definitely going to keep a watch out. This is really cool. It seems like it's sort of a supplement for the whole box, but mm-hmm. they just like chose to stick it here, and I think it fits here. But yeah, it was showing some clips of In the Mood for Love, which was making me really excited to watch that really soon. And Happy Together, some shots from that that looked really great. So yes, I'm continuing to be more excited as we get further into this. But that was, I thought that was really cool. Set. Probably my favorite supplement we've had thus far, I think.
Yeah, I think it's the most interesting one, considering like there were no commentaries so far, right, that we've seen on any of the disc in this set, which is a whole separate conversation about sort of the decline of the DVD commentary, and how I think that is an underrated thing. There's a lot of like archival interview stuff, or it seems like there are a lot of things where maybe like they talked to Christopher Doyle and they like chop that up to where it pertains to specific films, and so that sort of like parceled out over the course of the set.
Mm-hmm. Which is, yeah, that's the next thing on the disc. There's Christopher Doyle 2002 interview, which yeah, seems like it may have been shot in conjunction with the Chungking Express one we had last time. But yeah, he talks about just being comfortable with actors, which is interesting, and then the kind of wide angle lenses on this one. This was noted in one of the deleted scene kind of commentaries too, is that so the really great shot at the ending where we're close up on the woman's face while she's eating, and there's a bunch of violence happening behind her and she just doesn't care about it, which is such a cool shot that they shot that on like the first day of shooting, and that actually helped to kind of define how the film was going to look, because we could then get a lot of these wide angle lenses, we get these like close-ups of people's faces and just half the screen. Actually a lot of just split screen stuff in the whole movie. There's a really great shot where so the killer's apartment is similarly to Christopher Doyle / Tony Leung's apartment in Chungking Express. It's right outside of a lot of people traveling. So in that, in Chungking Express, of course, it's the escalators. In this, we have like a road and an elevated train, like right just spitting distance right from his window. And there's a really cool shot where it's exactly split screen, where we can see the road and the train and all the things happening there on half the screen. And the other half, we see him, we can see like his whole apartment, because it's a long, skinny room, and we can see all the things he's doing. And it's like a really nice long shot. So anyway, lots of wide angle lenses and kind of split screen things happening in this one. Christopher Doyle also talks about color theory. I thought that was cool, and kind of how it's different in East and West. And that's something I haven't thought about as we're watching through these, but it makes a lot of sense. Like, a Western director probably would use color in very different ways than a director from the East. And yeah, the, and the color is such an interesting part of these.
Yeah, there's, you know, there was an episode of the podcast, Film Formerly, where they talk about the use of color in Wong Kar-wai's films. And it's one of those things that sort of like kind of made me sort of question, like one of the hosts makes the comment that like, so like typically there's like a set of rules or an idea or specific practice behind the use of color, and that Wong Kar-wai obeys none of that. And it just strikes me like, it seems like, well, that's all like sort of like Western thought or like taught like in certain like schools of filmmaking, and like that everybody adheres to that. So of course people do use color in different ways. And I think like, I wish people would sort of, well, and maybe we'll talk about this when we talk about like the differences in the film and sort of the approach to restoration, which is a conversation that we've been having throughout this, but just like, there are different ideas behind all of these things, right? Like fidelity to past versions, or how you use color or cinematography or whatever. And I think people should be like more receptive to different things.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that kind of gets into the version question here too. So there's only one version of the film on the disc here, but there is another version available on Criterion Channel right now, which is called the theatrical cut. And I've seen a couple things online that's like color comparisons between two versions. I'm guessing that's the version we're looking at compared to this one. And this one has a little bit more of the kind of green tint versus more bluish, at least in the, there's a shot I've seen side by side of the two characters on the motorcycle, which I can't remember which two, because multiple characters get on motorcycles together in this film. But, and one, the, like this newer version looks very green compared to the old version. I think I like that Christopher Doyle talks about just how subjective that really is. Like, what does a color mean, you know? And it's really more about a feeling, and it's not something that means one thing to everyone, you know?
Right. Everybody brings their own experience with many things to a film.
So that's the Christopher Doyle interview. Also on the disc are three deleted scenes, which, just like on Chungking Express, it's like some interview about the film and then some kind of extra footage, basically, that none of them had a huge bearing on the story or anything. Although the first one, the first one is called Only You. And yeah, it is the first one that it kind of gives an alternate ending almost, it seems like. So the film ends, we have that shot of her eating with the violence behind her, and then she and Takeshi kind of connect and ride off on the motorcycle together, and that's kind of how the film ends. In this footage, we see them kind of continue on, and they actually have a kiss at a gas station. That's interesting. That's not there. But then it ends, like, then they part, and it looks like then the film would end with him by himself on the motorcycle in a very similar shot to what we get in the movie. So that's kind of interesting. But also they talk, Wong Kar-wai talks about the parallels between this and Chungking Express and some of the connections there. It shows a few shots back and forth of like Fei Wong dancing, and then Takeshi's character in this dancing, and like almost a very similar dance move, or the killer's partner spreading out the sheets on the bed, and then Fei Wong spreading out a tablecloth, and like the same motion. That was kind of a cool, some visual parallels there. Then the next one is called Whom You Miss, and it is almost all about the father character, and it kind of talks about what we already talked about, how he's how he became involved with the film. And we just get like a little interview with him, which is actually, this is my favorite supplement, or my favorite of the three deleted scenes, at least, because he talks about his experience with it. And now he has all these fans now, and he was nominated for Best New Actor in some award show. And then at the end, he says, "I watched the film twice and I still don't understand it." That's great. And then, and just also talked about the real life connection that he and Takeshi had. And now that kind of, you really can feel that in the movie, the connection between those two characters. And then the final deleted scene is called A Beautiful Evening, and it is about that final shot of them in the restaurant again that I've referenced, with the fighting happening in the background and the close-up of the actress's face in the foreground, and how that was one of the first things they shot and how that defined the style of the film. We get a colorized version of that shot, which is interesting, because in, at least in this version, the film, that shot is all in black and white. And then also there's a little shot of how they did the motorcycle shots, because there's a lot of motorcycle shots in this film, which are really cool. And then we see like the camera rig that was attached to the front of a motorcycle that they were riding on together. So that was kind of cool. And then there's a trailer on the disc as well. So that is all the supplements we get here. Let's talk about, well, we're going to talk more about the different versions, do you think?
We can talk about, well, I guess it'd be more conceptually about like the idea, right, mm-hmm. of it. Which is something that we keep coming back to, where there tends to be people, and in this instance, I'm looking at a site called The Cinema Escapist, where they're talking about the changes in this article. And their view seems to be that, so they're talking about the changes, specifically the change of the aspect ratio and what that does to the film. Although I would say that as I was watching it, I didn't notice anything off about sort of like the distortedness of the image, or the like the green color tinting again did not stand out to me as I was watching it. Perhaps this is because I wasn't watching it side by side with the previous version. But they make the point here that all of these changes wouldn't be a problem if both Fallen Angels versions became available side by side, which is something else that critics have brought up. But, you know, they're not available on the disc, but they are available on the channel, you mm-hmm. know. So, and I think before we did Chunking Express and I hadn't explored to see what was available on the Criterion channel, it was a view that I was sympathetic with, even if I didn't entirely agree with it, you know, like mm-hmm. it's not their job to make sure that you always have this version of the film that you always saw. But they are available on the channel. So if you set up for mm-hmm. the streaming service, you have access to it, and perhaps one day it'll be available in disc form again. But then they also just make the point that it says beyond the audiovisual text though, is the cultural significance of Fallen Angels with that twist the knife, featuring bedazzling shots of world-renowned yet fading or bygone Hong Kong sites like neon-lit billboards and Kai Tak Airport. Fallen Angels is a city film through and through. But it still is that. You know, like, to me, mm-hmm. I don't think the changes are drastic enough that most people would notice. But it also, you know, and the other thing is, as we brought up before, change is a part of, well, it's part of life, and I think a lot of these films are about that, but it's also a part of the Hong Kong film market in general. There's a David Borwell article where he talks about how often, you know, they will have sort of like a Hong Kong version of a film, an international version of the film, which is often a festival mm-hmm. version of the film, a Taiwanese version of the film, a version for the Japanese market. And it just seems like it's a common practice to have different versions of the film. So then at that point, who's to say, like, what is the most authentic version of the film anyway? And why yeah. should they be, why should they be beholden to the version that you happen to see, you know, in 2010 or whenever?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's because that's your version or whatever, which I think it's fine to, you know, have a favorite too and kind of consider that. But yeah. And I wonder how, you know, we have these different versions available streaming now. I hope that remains the case. I don't know if these are part of the permanent collection. They probably are not, but at least those are out there and hopefully will be available going forward for at least some amount of time. But yeah, I think it's interesting. I have not watched the other version. I may get curious and put it on at some time just to kind of flip through and see how different it feels. Because yeah, I think this is, so actually this is not the only one with the aspect ratio changed, although, so the other two, I'm looking at a note here on criterion.com, Chunking Express and In the Mood for Love were shot and released theatrically in 1.66:1, but then they were converted to 1.85 on video, so this takes them back to their original aspect ratio in the box set of 1.66. And then with Fallen Angels, he says he changed it to CinemaScope, which was his original intention, but wasn't possible at the time, and now it's and actually, there's a little video clip I haven't watched here in this article. I'll link to it. But I think it shows a comparison between the two aspect ratios. It's on Criterion's website. So yeah, interesting to note the changes there. But yeah, again, both versions are currently available to stream on the channel. But I thought this version looked great on the disc. It's, again, a lot of really great camera work and everything looking nice and crisp on Blu-ray. Yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah. And I do know, I think it's worth pointing out, just even though it is spiritually connected to Chunking Express, they did do things to intentionally separate it, right, and to make distinguish it from that film, like using the wide angle lens that distorts the perspective. You know, it creates this distance between characters in the foreground and the background. And then Tony Raines, somewhere, it might have been in the commentary for Chicken Express, and it might have been another feature, talks about how after sort of the success of Chicken Express and then the release of Fallen Angels, Wong Kar-wai deliberately changes his style and changes his approach as a way to be like not too self-referential or almost become parody. And I think that's going to be something to look out for as we go forward.
Do you think that main split is between this and Happy Together, or Happy Together and In the Mood for Love?
I suspect it's going to start with Happy Together, but I can't say for sure because I haven't seen it. Another claim that Tony Raines makes is that, and we'll probably go into this a lot with In the Mood for Love, but essentially the claim that he makes is that Wong Kar-wai becomes his own director of photography, even though there are other people handling the camera.
So that he can picture it as much in his head, that he can have that kind of control.
Right. And you know, what we'll see is there will be films where, and it's already happened, right, with Chicken Express, there are two people who are behind the camera. But like with In the Mood for Love, because of the length of that shoot, there were several people who were holding the camera. And as Tony Raines says, when you're watching the film, you'd be hard pressed to pick out who shot what. So yeah, that, you know, we'll get into that probably here in a few weeks. So.
Yeah. Well, only thing left on my to-do list here was to kind of talk through some favorite moments or any other things that you really liked about the movie. I have a few kind of notes here. I really like there's a line about most people work from 9 to 5 and I'm just the opposite. That was the killer's assistant or partner says that, and kind of gets at the idea that this is like a night movie, and it really does happen in the dead of night for most of it. Takeshi's character also has a line when we first see him in one of these shops that he's breaking into. It's a butcher shop, and he's talking about how surely people want to buy pork at 3 a.m. He's like messing with his pig and stuff, which is a kind of a funny thing. But yeah, all of this happens like in the middle of the night. I really like the music in this. There's again some repeated songs. There's like songs that characters are listening to, like diegetically, but then there's a lot of almost hip hop kind of music, or like there's a lot more of a beat to a lot of the music in a way that I thought was pretty cool. It gave it more of an action movie feel, which this has more kind of action and violence than most of the previous films that we've watched, with the exception of maybe As Tears Go By.
Yeah, it felt to me sometimes like a 90s thriller, or like a Showtime sexy movie or something. I don't know. What is that? Like an erotic thriller. Yeah. Right.
And to that point, it's probably the sexiest movie so far. Maybe that's not true, but it has a little bit more explicit things happening on camera than we've seen up to this point, which kind of lends to its gritty feeling a little bit too. But yeah, like even if you put in the Blu-ray disc and the menu music is like one of these songs that has such a strong beat. It's like, wow, this movie sounds pretty cool. Like a lot of the music is just really cool. Yeah, I put here the camera's always unpredictable, especially like the first half or so. It's like just moving so much, as I mentioned. We get a lot of that motion blur, just really kinetic, a lot of camera movement. And it just jumps from thing to thing so quickly that I'm just keep having little flashes of remembering, like, oh yeah, there's a whole scene where he's hiding from the police in... I'm not even sure where he is, but like the people that work there are covering for him. And like, that's an interesting little vignette. There's like all these little scenes of things happening. We talked about how, his partner who's obsessed with the killer's partner who's obsessed with him would go to the bar where when he's not there, and sit in his seat. And yeah, again, just kind of the connection there with Chunking Express of like, feeling connected to someone and going to the physical spaces that they inhabit, and kind of using that. And that's actually too where some of that sexuality comes in, because she kind of has some sexual exploration within his apartment by herself while he's not there. But yeah, we talk about the jukebox, the expired pineapple comes up again. Actually, maybe we didn't go into detail on that, but there's a funny line where or actually that he kind of says that's why he stopped talking, Takeshi's character. He said he ate a can of expired pineapple when he was a child and stopped talking at that point. Like, that's the reason. Which, again, it's his character in the other film that's eating the pineapple, so a direct connection there. One of the characters, too, says that they were born in Taiwan, moved to Hong Kong at age 5, and worked in Chungking Mansion, which exactly, I guess that was Takeshi's character, that exactly mirrors Wong Kar Wai's actual life, right?
Or
pretty close.
I think it might also mirror that actor's life, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's what. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Takeshi's. Yeah, that's correct. And here he speaks so many languages in reality and in Chungking Express, and then is silent in this movie. Although we do get a lot of narration from him. I had a note here that there's an interesting shot in one of the action scenes, where we actually have like a blood splatter on the camera, which I haven't seen anything like that so far in this box set.
And maybe you think of Children of Men.
Yeah, I love that movie. Yeah, if that feels more modern in a way than I just didn't expect it, I guess, which I guess kind of gets to what you're saying. This feels more like a 90s action movie than previous films in the box. Leaving clues for each other, and then he leaves the clue for her with the jukebox. I already talked about that. There's a lot made out of blonde hair, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. So there is the character Blondie that the killer meets in McDonald's, and they have this relationship. She has blonde hair. She talks about at one point about, you know, I dyed my hair blonde to make myself unforgettable. And of course we have a woman in a blonde wig in Chungking Express. There's also the character Charlie in this is on the phone yelling about her ex who is marrying someone named Blondie. Not the same person though, but so there are two characters named Blondie, or at least that's their nicknames. And then Takeshi's character also, his hair starts turning blonde, which is a funny, weird little aside that, like, as he's getting close with Charlie, his hair, he starts having blonde highlights without having done anything. And then when they break up, when she disappears, it goes away. It's like a weird thing about blonde hair again, happening in this movie. Oh, and I just want to, I can probably end with this, just that I really like the father-son relationship. And a big part of that is so this character doesn't speak. He's voluntary mute, but he ends up kind of speaking through filmmaking in a way. He has this video camera and he follows his dad around and like makes just this silly video of kind of their life. And then probably my favorite scene of the whole movie is where he secretly finds his dad watching the video and just kind of laughing and smiling. And he has some line about in the narration about who knows why he's laughing at this, but it's like this really wonderful father appreciating his son. And again, like, he doesn't speak with words, but he's able to kind of speak with his art in a way. And sort of anytime I see someone with a camera, I'm like, are they kind of standing in for the filmmaker in a way or something? I like that whole storyline. I thought it was really great.
Yeah. You know, I think it's like, the more I think about it, the more lots of the film appeals to me. There's a lot of comedy and scene.
It's really funny. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, it's like the McDonald's scene, right? Where like the woman Blondie walks up to him and asks if she can sit there, and the camera pans around and there's nobody else at any other table there.
The camera gives us the punchline to that, which is fun.
Yeah. And I think there's also like value in the film as just like a document of a particular area of Hong Kong. Like, so where the film was shot was an area that was distinct from where, even though like parts of it takes place in Chungking Mansions, part of it was also shot in a place called Wan Chai, if I'm pronouncing that right. It's Wanchai. And it says that Wong specifically chose those locations because he could feel that they were going to change, right? Like, like that there was some sort of development or something that was going to happen. And in that sense,
it now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
Right. And so there's like, and then there's all this like beautiful photography of like the nighttime streets that also almost look like they've been like purposely wet. Right. So that they kind of shine, and like this, like stretching neon lights from the effect, the step printing effect they use that he used before. So like just have these lines of neon. And so there's a lot there. I feel like I came off too negative on it. and so I'm trying to walk it back, but also, you know, it's just, there's just something about it. It's not as whimsical to me as like Chungking Express. It's much darker. You know, it's a bleaker film in the end, yeah. I think.
Both and, thematically and visually, it's right. a lot darker. Yeah.
And that might be a lot of what I'm responding to.
Yeah. Some of the comedy is kind of dark too. So like there's, I mean, it is really funny that one of the shops he breaks into is an ice cream shop. And so one of the funniest things. So we see him like giving this guy a haircut when at some point that he's broken into a barber shop, like being pretty violent with this guy and like cutting his, like, shaving his face against his will. And like, this guy's trying to run away. And then he comes up to the ice cream shop. And he's like, oh no, it's you again. Like, what are the odds? And, but then later in the movie, and it's like his whole family ends up coming to the ice cream shop, which is, it's like a weird thing. And it's an ice cream truck. So they end up driving around the city too. But then the part that I was like, what just happened is when that guy, he interacts with that guy again. And he's like, I'll come back, I promise. And he's like, I don't believe you. And then he shuts the door and it sounds like he's like chopping his fingers off. Is that how you read that scene?
I don't know what he was doing, but yes, it sounds very violent and very disturbing.
There's something about breaking the bones in his body and he has a huge knife. Yeah, I was like, whoa, that got really dark really quick. But it's also sort of played for laughs, I think. I don't know. But that was an interesting moment. That character, that side character who just keeps interacting with him was funny throughout, even though it had that dark ending. But yeah. And maybe we can kind of finish with the kind of the ending of the film too, which, so there's a lot in this film about breakups, and it's like there's a pretty memorable breakup scene between the killer and Blondie, kind of in the lobby of her apartment building, and she's incredibly upset, and she's kind of violent with him, and she's like all over the place, but then they have like a goodbye kiss that's really interesting, and then his narration talks about, you know, that's the moment where he says like, I'm just a stopover in her life, she'll find someone who really loves her. And there's kind of a sense of like their relationship was meaningful, even though it wasn't meant to last forever. And then that is echoed again in the very final line of the film. It's the killer's partner, who's now with Takeshi on the motorcycle. And she, her narration is talking about, you know what? I'm trying to remember. So actually, just before that, we have Takeshi's narration, and he says a lot of the things directly from Chungking Express about rubbing elbows with strangers. Some of them become our friends and confidants, which I think is just exactly lifted directly from that other one. But then where I was going was the end of the film. It's her narration, and she says, like, I know this isn't going to last forever, but in that moment, I felt such warmth. And I think that's like the final words. So again, getting to that idea that, you know, there's a human connection, even though that's, you know, fleeting in some sense, like doesn't mean it's not worthwhile or beautiful in its own way.
I feel like part of my antipathy is that it feels like a backward step, because it is more of a genre film. Mm-hmm. It has more of those elements. And I don't think Wong Kar-wai is John Woo. And it's not that he's necessarily trying to be, but like it is very, it's, I don't know, it seems like it's trying to be more really of an action movie. And I just, it's like, it doesn't feel authentic to me.
Like the general kind of direction of his career is less and less genre stuff, but, and yet this would, yeah, not fit in that.
Yeah. And just like a world of like hitmen. Yeah. And like, it's just, I don't know. It just doesn't work for me. And then, and the other story, like 223 as like this pixie manic dream guy that isn't quite, you know, like it doesn't, like the stuff with Fei Wong in Chungking Express is like, to me, like it avoids that trope because she is a person who has agency and she does decide to leave and sort of find herself, and as opposed to sort of like fulfilling this other person's dreams. Whereas like 223, the criminal, I don't know, maybe I need to watch it. I need to watch it again, like during the day, you know.
Yeah, and now I'm wanting to watch that other version too. So like maybe if I make the time for that, we can revisit on the podcast at some point. But yeah, that's really interesting. But yeah, so that is Fallen Angels. I'll say this too, like as I talk through it with you, I end up appreciating it more. So I think it's films that. Definitely, and this is very much the case with Annette too. I talked about this in my other interview with the other two filmmakers, but we all three were like, I wish we had someone else to talk to about this movie, like until we finally connected today on the podcast. Like no one else I know has watched this and I'm dying to talk about it. And I definitely over time with that film, Annette liked it even more. And I think that's kind of happening here too. Anyway, so that is Fallen Angels. Next time we will look at Happy Together, which you have not seen. Is that true?
I have not seen it. I am very excited to watch it though, and then talk about it.
Yes, it is a love story. It's a gay love story, which is interesting. First one in the set for that. It also has some characters from previous film or actors from previous films. Some familiar faces, but we'll talk about all of that next time. So we will talk about Happy Together and go through that disc on the box set. But, all right. Well, thank you so much, Amaya. Any final thoughts or anything?
Watch more movies.
Watch more movies. There you go. I love it. Well, we will talk to you again next time. Thanks again, and we'll see you then. Oh, Maya Jones killed it as always in that conversation. Thanks again for all you bring to these discussions. And that will do it for this show. Stay tuned for next time. We will continue the Wong Kar-wai talk with Happy Together, and we'll review something else on the show, which is currently to be determined. And that does it for this episode of Art House Garage. Thanks so much for listening. We've got a few years worth of episodes now, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. You can learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can always email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or you can find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.